use them to reflect on their lives. And these are pretty relatively universal things that most people understand pretty simply. It's the kind of things that I want my two-year-old to understand when he goes to the playground. And not to harm or not to kill. He doesn't kill so much, but, you know. Mine. And then not to steal. And he hasn't been involved in sexual misconduct yet, but no sexual misconduct. And then no lying. And avoiding of intoxicants or avoiding the abuse of intoxicants. And last week I gave an overview on the topic, and this week I'd like to talk a little bit about the first precept, which is the precept of not killing. And to start, I'd like to read this wonderful article by John Carroll. We arrived in Nepal during a festival called Durga Puja, which is a celebration of the Hindu deity Durga, who is an aspect of Devi and the goddess of warfare and other malevolent acts. The Hindu citizens of Kathmandu celebrated with parades and chaotic music making. I remember standing in a doorway on a narrow street near midnight, crushed in a crowd, watching a statue of the adamantine sow being borne aloft by revelers. I thought, not in Kansas. Another aspect of Durga Puja was animal sacrifices. The American embassy, wishing not to offend the host country, slaughtered a goat near the entrance. Photos of this event were not encouraged. I often wondered how it was handled in the expense reports. The Buddhist residents had a dilemma. They were a tiny minority in the capital city. They too wished not to offend, but slaughtering animals was contrary to the tenets of their religion, which is not to kill. So, they slaughtered melons. On Buddhist doorsteps all over the city were the pulpy remains of fruit that had been cleaved by machetes. It was important, it seemed, that it looked brutal. Not a clean slice as though one were preparing cantaloupes for dessert, but a great heedless whack with seeds adhering to the walls and pulp like pieces of flesh decomposing on the pavement. Thus the goddess was appeased, and another strange artifact of assimilation was born. So, slaughtering melons, because one of the Buddhist tenets, one of the basic principles that Buddhists live by, is the principle of not killing. And it has an ancient Indian pedigree, this principle of not killing. And in part, the Buddhists might have been inspired by the Jain example. And the Jains have even a more strict principle of not killing than the Buddhists do. The Jains try very hard to avoid any kind of even unintentional killing of insects or bugs or anything. And the Jain monastics will wear these gauze face masks over their mouths in order to prevent any insects from flying into their mouth while they're breathing or talking, and thereby inadvertently kill some being. The Buddhists have a little different take on the precept of not killing than the Jains, though the principle of not killing is extremely important for Buddhists. And it's been said that when Buddhist kings came to power in ancient India, one of the characteristics of their reigns was they would abolish capital punishment and had other kind of expressions of non-killing. But the Buddhist take on the principle of not killing, the kind of so-called, maybe using the word moral maybe is a little bit awkward in the moral West, but the Buddhist focus on not killing focuses on the issue of the intention is the most important thing. Is if you kill something inadvertently, if you run over an animal or an insect or something in your car as you're driving, and there's no intention, you had no intention, you weren't trying to, you weren't thinking of doing it, you didn't want to do it, you maybe preferred not to do it, But somehow in the course of events, you step on a bug and you kill the bug. The Buddha said in that case, there was no karmic repercussions for yourself. There was no, and karma in Buddhism, specifically Buddhism, has to do with the repercussions. We can say, in shorthand, we can say in your spiritual life or in your psyche. There might be other consequences in the world. We don't know about that. But the way in which we create habit formations, the way the kind of invisible channels in which things, seeds get planted in the mind and then bear fruit in future times, affecting our ability to be happy, our ability to be awake and free, has to do with our intention, the kind of intentions we follow through on. If we follow through our intentions of greed and hate, then that sets the, it has in motion a certain kind of habit formation in the mind, which makes it harder for us to be happy or become liberated in the future. It kind of makes the mind a little bit more sticky. And so it's hard to let go of our clinging because the mind is a little bit sticky. But if we follow through on motivations of generosity or love or wisdom, that tends to make the mind less sticky. And so it's a lot easier then in the future to free the mind, which is the ultimate purpose of Buddhism, is to attain nibbana, or the release of the mind, the freedom of the heart from all its fetters and its all that binds it. So Buddhism tends to focus on the intention as being what's kind of morally significant. If there's no intention, then there's no karmic significance in the act. It might have other significances, but karmically there's none. It might have other consequences, but in this karmic way Buddhism talks about karma, it has no consequence. So in that sense, Buddhists aren't as careful as the Jains are with their behavior. There are examples of Buddhist monastics who do filter the water before they drink it so that they can catch whatever insects are in there so they don't kill it. And Buddhists try to live to cause as least amount of harm in the world as possible. But there isn't the kind of hyper-alertness that maybe the Jains would have. However, the Jain example, I think, has inspired Buddhists. And part of the strength of the nonviolent tradition in Buddhism actually comes as an inspiration from the Jain example. So it's a very important principle, the principle of non-harming. It's also the first precept, the precept not to kill. The way that the precept is worded in Pali, the word is panatipata varamani sikappadam samadhiyami. For the sake of my training, as a training rule, I undertake the rule of not, it's usually translated, it's understood to be not to kill, but I think the way it means panatipata means, pana means breath, like the word, like the Sanskrit word prajna, right? It also can mean breath, prajna. And so pana means breath, and apati, panatipati, means to strike or to harm or to torment. So it has a little bit broader meaning, perhaps, in its etymology than just to kill. It can mean just not to harm sentient beings, beings that breathe. And it's understood in the ancient Buddhist world that plants don't breathe. So it's kind of our division of sentient and insentient. Not to harm, not to torment, not to strike. And now what gets interesting is that stated as a precept, it's a training precept, and it's the first level of understanding non-killing. The level that it's a training precept. It's a pragmatic tool to help our practice. It's a pragmatic tool for us to help become liberated, to let our practice develop. And in that sense, it could be maybe seen to be even a little bit selfish. You don't kill someone else. You don't kill animals because it's good for your practice not to kill. And it's various ways in which it helps you. But the most simple way is has nothing to do with ethics, but rather it's a rule of restraint where you vow not to do this activity. And because you committed yourself not to do this activity, you get to watch all the impulses to kill. And you, sometimes when you follow through on an impulse, you don't really see it that well. Whether it's to, you know, to impulse shopping, or whether it's, you know, impulse lying, or whatever it is. When, if you have, if it, sometimes it's really easy to follow through an impulse, you don't see it. But if there's a limitation and you can't do it, you kind of put a self-imposed kind of fence around yourself, and you say, well, I can't go there, I can't do that activity. Then sometimes we see that impulse much more clearly. And so, for example, in the precept of not killing, when you go to practice on a retreat, or you go live in a Buddhist monastery, you're expected to follow that precept really strictly. Not to kill any sentient beings. And the place where it tends to become the greatest challenge is with insects, because most people who go to Buddhist monastery are not about to punch out their neighbor there. Though it does occur. And I think the only time in my adult life where I was about to punch someone out was in a meditation hall. That was a wake-up call for me. I said, wow, you know, this teaching that, you know, see the other in yourself. But usually with insects, and like in Asia, you're not supposed to kill the insect that lands on your chin, on your cheek. And it's a wonderful practice because you get to see a phenomenal number of impulses. And you see aversion and anger and despair and discouragement and hate. And it's quite fascinating to hear. You know, it's a great meditation. It's one of the secret meditations they don't teach you. And you get very concentrated. You know, you hear the buzz, and then you feel the land. If you're deeply in deep meditation, you're very sensitive. You feel walking around. And then you don't have to feel anything for a little bit. And you've learned, because you've done this a number of times, that when you don't feel anything, don't hear anything, it's because you're numb for a few moments while it's doing its work. And then at some point you hear it buzz away or walk away, and after a while you feel a little bit itching. And it's kind of, you know, by the time it's done, you're very concentrated. Now, you might think that this is completely ridiculous to do such a thing, but for the sake of concentration, can be very helpful. But for the sake of really seeing what drives you, because the impulses, same impulses to reaction to the mosquito, are very kind of more subtle, perhaps, or much more easy to see, are the same impulses you'd have about, you know, punching out the guy who cut you off in traffic, or the same kind of impulses of aversion, impulses of aggression, can occur in real life situations where it's really good to have done the training to really seen these impulses and really gotten to know them, so that in real life situations maybe you're not going to act on them impulsively, but rather see them clearly and learn that you have the ability to be free in the middle of those impulses. And that's part of the training, is to learn to see the impulses, to have the restraint that prevents you from acting impulses, so you can see them free completely, so that you can discover the freedom, the peacefulness of heart, the peace of mind that exists by not acting on those impulses. But this, I think, is sometimes a very difficult idea for Westerners in America, because the idea of freedom in the West is also often freedom to do whatever our impulse is. The freedom in Buddhism is freedom from these impulses, so we can act wisely. So the first level of the precepts is that a level of restraint. And it's basically, you know, you can say, I don't want to say selfish, but for your own sake that we do this, for our own training. It has no ethical value in and of itself. It's just, you know, valuable to have that restraint and see those impulses. I might mention the story of the two acrobats. They were acrobats who would stand on each other, like one would stand on the head of the other, or, you know, they'd stand on one foot and the hand of one, you know, upside down, you know, and on one hand, the other, one person would hold his hand up like this, and the other one would be upside down holding, being supported with one hand. So that kind of acrobat. And the one who was going to be up in the air, this is a famous Buddhist story that Buddha told. So the one up in the air said, and I think the one on the ground said, I'll watch over you, and you watch over me, and that way we'll both be protected. And the one up in the air said, no, that's not the way we do it. I'll watch over myself, and you watch over yourself, and that way we'll both be protected. And the Buddha said, yeah, that's the way it is. That if you really watch over yourself carefully and protect yourself, in protecting yourself, you'll protect others. And it's kind of the example that Joseph Goldstein gave last Sunday, that if two people are in the mud, it's very hard to pull yourselves out in the quicksand. But if one person has their foot on dry land, then it's a lot easier to pull both of them out. So we protect ourselves first. Just really understand our own impulses, our own reactivity. Really to deeply understand, not only to understand, but to actually begin bringing into actuality the freedom of mind. To have a mind, a heart, which is free from our impulses, that can live spaciously and openly. So the first level of the precepts of not to kill is just simply a training rule to help us understand ourselves better. This is not very satisfying for many people because many people are motivated by compassion. And the next level of the precept of not to kill is a principle of compassion, the principle of not harming, because we don't want to see someone else harmed. As we get more sensitive in the practice, or any way in which we get more sensitive to life around us and to our life within us, I think it's pretty natural for people not to want to cause harm, not to want to see someone else harmed. So rather than avoiding swatting the mosquito because we're trying to develop our own personal practice, we avoid swatting the mosquito because we care about the mosquito. But there's some compassion, some concern about this life, living being. And so we restrain ourselves because of this compassion. And this, I think, is really the heart of the virtue which is being developed through practice. Practice develops virtue within us, virtuous qualities, a virtue of sensitivity to well-being of other people and to well-being of ourselves, so that naturally we don't want to harm other people. So the precept of not to kill is not so much a precept, but an expression of a principle by which we want to live. And this principle then has expression in many different areas of our life. This is what comes to mind right now, is when the Buddha talked about the precept of not to kill, one of the expansions of this precept he talked about was there should be no punishment. Now that's a very interesting expansion of it, because as a culture, as a society here in the West, and we put a lot of, not any of us here, of course, but we put a lot of value on the importance of handing out punishment in our judicial system. And capital punishment is the most severe form of that. And there's kind of trends in our judicial system, in between the idea of rehabilitation of criminals versus a punishment. And some people just think it should be pure, outright punishment, just lock them up and give them a hard time, and that's all it's about. And other people feel it's very important to try to rehabilitate those people, to cultivate, develop empathy in them and the skills they need in order to live a life that doesn't cause other people harm. So the Buddha was very clear. He said that one of the extensions of the principle of not harming is to avoid punishment. I don't think it necessarily meant avoiding people, putting people in jail, but avoiding doing that as a punishment, where you're trying to harm someone in the act. Part of the reason for this is, again, a little bit self-centered, for one's own sake. Not only is it harmful for the person is being punished, or the person you're hurting in other contexts, but in order to strike at someone, in order to want to punish someone, if you wanted to punish your neighbor for playing music at midnight, or whatever you want to do, jibe at someone or criticize someone because you kind of get back at them or something, the act of aversion, the act of wanting to harm someone, requires us to suffer in doing the act. It's not possible to want to harm someone and act on that intention without some kind of contraction in our heart, in our mind, in our body. some kind of tightening, some kind of suffering within us. Occasionally people are so delighted by the idea of harming someone that delight, that kind of unhealthy delight, obscures the fact that they're suffering in doing that act. But from a selfish point of view, we don't mete out punishment because we don't want to harm ourselves. But we find other means of taking care of the same situation. The avoiding of punishment is not the avoidance of figuring out methods of reconciliation, methods of atonement, methods of somehow dealing with the real world situations. But can we find other ways besides punishment? The other another application of the idea of not harming and living a life of compassion is to plan ahead. And this is a little bit hard for us. If we're going to live with some dedication to the idea of being nonviolent, and what a great day to talk about nonviolence, right? Martin Luther King Day. I mean, I'm so inspired by the civil rights movement, by the tremendous power of people who saw the effectiveness of civil disobedience, the effectiveness of not allowing themselves to respond to violence with violence. The common sense approach when you're being attacked is to fight back. And people will have great philosophies of the importance of being of self-defense and fighting back. And here were people who went down to the South and stood in street corners and allowed themselves to get beat up without any attempt at self-defense. In order to do that, people like Martin Luther King and people he trained had to rely on a tremendous strength of character. It wasn't a weak thing to do. It wasn't a tremendous courage to do that. And in our common sense world, we're supposed to always defend ourselves. But the fact that people were willing to live that way and act that way had phenomenal repercussions in American society and beyond. The strength of civil rights movements had a lot to do with the strength of people who were willing to put their life on the line. And not defend themselves, but rather to defend themselves with the strength of their character, their courage, and their passive resistance to the situation. So that's kind of maybe somewhat dramatic, but I remember, maybe it was one of you here, some years ago, one of the people in our Sangha came to me to ask me, said she felt unsafe going into downtown Palo Alto at night, and she was thinking of getting a gun. And what did I think about that? Generally, I don't like to be in the position of giving my opinion on such things. But what I said to this woman was, I acknowledged that there might be some real danger. I mean, there was someone killed in downtown Palo Alto a couple of years ago, right? Remember that? So there are dangers in the world. You can get killed almost anywhere. But there's a tendency in American culture to reach for the gun first without any attempt to educate oneself at other options that we might have at self-defense. So the idea of planning ahead, if you want to somehow live by the principle of compassion, concern for the well-being of others, not to harm others, to really follow through on it in a serious way, actually, I think requires preparation to train ourselves, to educate ourselves in the different ways in which we can respond that might be alternatives to responding with a gun. So meditation is a great way of doing that, because if you develop the ability to stay calm in frightening situations, the ability to see clearly in difficult, challenging situations, you might actually have the clarity of mind to know a better response than to reach for your gun. So this man, I think it was in Walnut Creek, who defended himself with his gun recently and was shot and died. So it raised the whole issue of statistically, are you better off defending yourself with a gun, or are you better off not having a gun? What are your chances of getting hurt? And some statistics show that you're more likely to get hurt if you have a gun in your defense. But you want to live by statistics. You know, you feel safer with a gun, right? Forget about statistics. That doesn't count for anything. But I've had lots of friends. I've never been held up at gunpoint or at knife point. But I've had friends when I was living in San Francisco Zen Center, where Zen Center was surrounded by, back then, very poor and very dangerous neighborhood, who were held up at knife point, held up at gunpoint. I have friends who were knifed. I have friends who were shot living there. And over and over again, I heard stories from these people about how they were able to stay calm in these situations. And a certain clarity of mind was there. They attributed to their meditation practice, the cumulative effect of the meditation practice, that helped them in those situations from letting the situation be a lot worse. So I don't know how convincing these kinds of stories are to you, but the point I'm trying to say is that if we want to live a life of compassion, it requires more than just wishful thinking, but it also requires some kind of preparation. And meditation is one of them. Really understanding how our impulses and reactivity are, and learning how to be free of those things in difficult situations. And then if you're really concerned, you might do something else. You might do nonviolent training. There's all kinds of ways of getting training. Educating oneself on options besides violent options when someone comes to you with violence. It takes some courage to be interested in this, because there's always risk. We never know, right? You never know whether your options, your alternatives are going to work. But what do we base our life on? Do we want to base our life on values that inspire other people, perhaps, to live nonviolently? Do we want to create a culture of that? I would like to do that myself. It's a very high inspiration for me. It's very important for me that Buddhist centers and Buddhist monasteries are havens of nonviolence. So there's at least some place in our culture that we know we can go there and we're not going to be met with violence. But this is a place dedicated to nonviolence. Now, in Buddhist Asia, sometimes society sometimes takes advantage of Buddhist monasteries in ways of discarding unwanted pets. Because they know that the monastery, no one's going to kill their pet. So monasteries end up with getting this surplus of pets, because people come at midnight and throw them over the fence and leave them there. So the principle of compassion, the precept of non-killing is simply an expression of compassion. How far do we want to extend that into our lives? One of the most common questions that people ask when I talk about the first precept in this kind of context, because I think most of you are not about to kill people, but you might consider the most likely place you might kill intentionally is with pests. Termites, snails in your garden. What do you do with them? When you actually confront an insect, what is your relationship to that insect? What is your relationship to the precept not to kill? It's very interesting to look at that, because sometimes Buddhists will respond to insects out of a should, out of a rule, in order to be a good Buddhist. Now, that you can do worse things with your life than that, so I'm not going to knock it exactly. But I don't think that's really allows you to get to the depth of the potential of virtue, of the precepts. Can you see in your relationship to that insect what your motivations are and what the consequences are to you yourself in carrying that motivation and following through on it? If it's a motivation of hate, do you really want to reap the fruit of acting on hate? If you really knew what will happen to you if you keep acting on impulses of hate, I think you'd never get close to it, because it has such deleterious effects to yourself. That's one way to study it. The other way to study it, do you have some feeling, heartfelt feeling, for that insect? What's interesting to me is that my heartfelt relationship to insects depends a lot on the state of my mind. If I'm really frazzled, I don't care so much about insects. If I am basically at peace with myself, not frazzled, contented, I actually feel a kind of empathy or a kind of connection to the insect, and I don't want to kill an insect because of that connection. This is why you should never talk about ethics or about ethics of punishment or self-defense with someone who's angry. Because you wait until they're in better mood and then talk about the philosophy of ethics with them. So where does the dedication... So I have a dedication to live by the precept as a training rule. What that means is when I meet an insect or meet anything, I won't just do it blindly as a rule, but I'll stop and start doing this investigation. What is my motivation? What is my relationship to this? And based on those two items, how do I want to act? So with insects, you know, if there's termites eating your house, what are you going to do? Buddhist monastics would let the house go. They just move someplace else. Buddhist monastics follow this rule quite strictly. But for lay people who have households and maybe children they have to raise, does it make sense for us to let the termites eat our house? If we own a house, for example, a lot of our security, a lot of our well-being, how we can take care of our family might be related to safeguarding this house. And if we just let the termites have their way, it might create a lot of harmful effects, in a sense, for your family. I can imagine that. But to kill the insects, the termites, is also doesn't feel right either. So what do you do? I think that's for a question each of us has to answer for ourselves and really grapple with that ourselves. And what I like a lot is when people come to groups like this and ask about, what do I do about the termites? I love it that people ask the question. How many times in our society do people stop and ask that question? Most time people just, reach for the raid, and start spraying without even thinking about it. I don't want to answer for anyone what they should do. But I think exploring these issues in a very mindful way, I think, is really, really important. But there's another way of looking at this, and that is, you have to prepare yourself. You have to look ahead. If you own a house, maybe you should think about termite-proofing the house before they arrive. So, for example, in our house, we moved up to our house. After we were living there for about a week or a few days, we noticed that the mice were eating our food. So we didn't go out and buy mouse traps to kill the mice. What we did is we cleaned the kitchen really well, and we went out and bought these plastic tubs, and we put all our food that could be reached by the mice into these plastic tubs and kept the floor swept well each day. And within a couple of days, there was no more mice, and they never came back. That was pretty simple. There's things you can do. So I think that to live a life of compassion, a life of non-harming, to kind of try to live by the first precept, it's helpful to do some preparation, to plan ahead, to think wider. This then enters into a whole other realm of the first precept, which some Buddhist teachers would consider to be optional. I have one friend who's a Buddhist teacher, a well-known Buddhist teacher, well-practiced person, who takes a very much of a very traditional approach to practice, and that is that just focus on your own intention. And if your intention isn't to cause any harm, don't worry, that's enough. Because that really is where the heart of your spiritual life is anyway. But I don't find that very satisfying, because the way that we act in the world has consequences beyond the karmic consequences of our, how it affects our psyche. So for example, and this is, you know, maybe I feel a bit uncomfortable saying this, but for example, if you're going to buy a car, do you consider how much that car is going to pollute in buying the car? Does that go into the equation of how you decide to buy a car? Because a car that pollutes more causes more harm. Do you try to minimize your harm? Now, there can be no intention in causing harm in getting your car. But your actions have consequences that cause harm. Are you interested in minimizing that harm? So my monastic friend, he's not interested in that kind of, he calls that political concerns. And I feel very uncomfortable him just kind of delegated it to politics, is that's not important. I think that's quite important, very important. And to feel some sense of responsibility for our actions in the wider world. And but then it gets very hard to know how well you should educate yourself, because the ripple of consequences of our action goes out quite far. So maybe this thing about the car, that's relatively easy to understand, and it's relatively easy to decide, well, I'm going to try to get a car that gets a better gas mileage and pollutes less. But what about, you know, the clothes you buy? You buy clothes from a sweatshop. Do you know if you buy clothes from a sweatshop? Do you do the research to find out? And it gets very murky and very gray, you know, exactly what the consequences are. But it's possible to do some study and some concern about the wider consequences of our actions. I think often in American culture there's such a value of consumerism that in the pursuit of consumerism, consumption, people often don't ask themselves the question of the what are the consequences of this act of consumption? Are there acts beyond consequences that I'd rather not have? And so I'll choose another option. I'll simplify my consumption. I'll choose the one that causes less harm. Well, my monastic friend, part of the reason why he didn't want to delegate this stuff to politics is that he doesn't want people to feel guilty or feel bad. He didn't use the word guilt. About something which they had no bad intention about. Your intentions are what's most consequential. And a lot of people feel guilty for actions in which they have no intention for. So that when we start taking care of the world, be stewards of the world in a wider way, by following the precept of not harming, it's not meant to be a guilt trip, which is a guilt in Buddhism is understood to be a form of self-aversion. But rather, it's supposed to be an expression of compassion. And can we live more compassionately? Can we express our compassions? Can we be interested in expressing our compassions? Can our compassion be? Can our compassion have a central value in our life? A central operating value in our life. What is the central operating values of your life? Many people, if you ask them what their central intention and motivation for their life is, it would be actually different than what their central operating motivation is. But if anthropologists studied you, what would they actually see, guess, is your operating intention? I think it's very easy to see that a lot of people in our culture, their operating intention is one of consumption, one of status, sometimes of power, sometimes of security. Do we want those things to be the center of what makes us tick? Or do we want to have compassion be more central in our life? Is it interesting? Is it valuable to do that? And the final thing about the first precept, which I'll say briefly, is that as we do the practice, as we practice the act of restraint and learn about ourselves and learn about the possibility of a heart and a mind that's free, that doesn't cling, that doesn't contract, and discover the possibility of having a mind which is at peace, and we start learning to take refuge in the mind that's at peace. Then you'll discover that from that place, you'll naturally not want to harm. It's not something that you have to work at or try to, you know, but rather it's as natural as it would be to you know, to put your hand on someone's shoulder when they're really distressed. Or it's as natural as you know, it's almost as if it's our innate nature when we're at peace not to cause intentional harm to any living being at all. So I hope that you take for this next week as a real challenge this question or this koan, this issue of not killing, not causing harm. Not moralistically, but rather take it first as just a very pragmatic tool to really study the ways in which you cause harm, intentionally might cause harm, and see if for this next week if you can hold back from doing it, from saying something unkind to someone, causing any kind of harm that you might cause intentionally, or the insects that come across your way. And then see what that teaches about yourself by holding back. And see if in exploring the topic of not killing and not harming, whether you can discover something about your innate capacity for compassion and empathy and connectedness with the world. And in doing that, see if that's something that's really valuable for you, whether you value that connection, that empathy. And in doing that, my last suggestion is you try to do that in a way that you enjoy it, rather than something heavy. Because living by the precepts in Buddhism is meant to be a joyful thing. It's supposed to bring you joy. And if you understand the innate purity of your heart, you'll really appreciate how this is a joyful thing. Okay? So that's the first precept. Good luck. Thank you.